This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Sports betting is now legal in Indiana. Hoosiers placed their first wagers in September and October, ushered in the opportunity to participate in mobile sports betting. Last month alone, $92 million were wagered in Indiana on sports. Joining us today to talk about how sports betting came to be legal in Indiana and what it means for casinos, players, and the state is Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon.
Hey there.
Indiana's just in the first few months of allowing people to legally participate in sports betting, both in the casinos and now online as well. But before we talk more about how it's going, let's talk about the timeline of how this came to be. The U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that got the ball rolling in 2018. What did this decision change?
It opened everything up. And some states had actually already prepared for this because – and I might get this wrong, but I think it was Delaware was the first to go. They essentially passed legislation even before the case was decided by the Supreme Court that said, if it becomes legal everywhere else, we're going to start doing it. Indiana was a little behind that. But what the Supreme Court said was that sports gaming was absolutely okay to do in any state that wanted to do it.
And as decisions around sports betting moved to the states, some considered it a controversial topic. What did that conversation look like in Indiana? What were the major components of the debate?
It was shockingly not controversial at the statehouse itself, to the point where it became something that people talked about how not controversial it was. Like the final floor debate, notably in the House, when the final bill was being passed, more than one lawmaker who wasn't very happy about the bill actually got up to the floor and said, "How are we doing this so quickly?" And in a sense, it's so quickly that it had just sailed through the process fairly easily. How are we doing this when a few years ago we talked about some minor changes to the state's casino industry and it was an uproar? And that, I think, caught some people by surprise. But I think if you wanted to point to a reason why it wasn't particularly controversial here, it was sort of like, well, we already have gambling, so this is just another way to do gambling. A lot of other states are going into it. We might as well jump on the bandwagon. And I will point to a lot of people who talk about this acknowledged correctly that – there's been sports gambling going on in Indiana and everywhere else for a very long time. But now we're going to do it legally.
Yeah.
We're going to regulate it. We're going to tax it.
Ultimately, House Bill 1015 was signed by Governor Eric Holcomb this past May, legalizing sports wagering. Did it pass with broad support?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the fun ones about any gaming legislation for us reporters at the State House is this one is not a party line vote, as many are. This one has support and opposition across the spectrum. Now, again, I said it passed fairly easily, and it did. There wasn't a lot of opposition to it from either party, but you certainly can't pin down an R versus D issue on this one.
Let's talk about some of the details here. First, how old do you have to be to participate in sports betting?
21, same age you have to be to go into a casino and place a bet right now on anything else.
And are all sports fair game? Can you bet on college sports?
Yes, to a point. There's a pretty long list of sports you're allowed to wager on. I don't imagine you would go into a sports book in this state and find something you're not find something you're probably looking for in terms of those wagers, but it stops at the college level. You cannot bet on high school sports, for instance, and as big as high school basketball is, and in the state of Indiana, you cannot place legal wagers on those games.
Ooh. What role has the Indiana Gaming Commission played throughout this process? What's their job?
So the bill pretty much – I mean, it said a lot of things, but when it comes to the sports wagering piece, it pretty much says, here you go, it's legal. The Gaming Commission comes up with a lot of the like, okay, this is exactly how you're going to do it, and this is how we're going to monitor you doing it, and this is how we're going to regulate you doing it, which is the Gaming Commission's role in gambling in the state in general. State law says not nearly as many things as the rules that the Gaming Commission actually sets up for casinos and gaming operators.
What's Indiana's tax rate on casino sports bets winnings? We know Pennsylvania enacted a tax rate as high as 34% on sports betting. And other states like Nevada are much lower at 6.7%. That's no surprise there. Where does Indiana fall there?
It taxes sports gambling at 9.5%.
Wow,
and this was, yeah, and this was not any one piece of this was necessarily controversial, but this was the one they probably spent the most time thinking about in terms of what are we trying to do in Indiana with that tax rate, which is to say Pennsylvania's rate is so high that you got to wonder if they're trying to scare some people off from even offering it. Because they don't feel like it's going to be profitable enough. In Indiana, we were trying to find a sweet spot between taxing it responsibly, but also encouraging people to come here and open up sports books, or maybe not come here and open up sports books, but certainly to get into the business of sports gaming, because it was really only going to be the current casino operators who could do it. But so finding that number was actually a subject of much debate behind mostly closed doors in the General Assembly, and 9.5 is ultimately where they landed.
And is that tax money going anywhere in particular?
It's part of the overall gaming pot, which goes a few different – it primarily goes into the state's coffers and then goes from there into a few different places, including to local governments. But it's all part of the rest of the – sports wagering dollars specifically aren't any different than – the money that's collected because of poker or blackjack or anything like that.
We talked about the big October number, the $92 million. September was the kickoff month, though, for sports betting, and you could do that at casinos. How did September go?
It was very slow to begin with because as much as it became legal September 1st, the Gaming Commission had to give you the okay to start. Mm. Because, again, as I talked about their rulemaking procedures, you had to go to them and say, okay, we are now – you know, we've done everything you've told us to do. Come out and give us the okay. They send somebody out. They check everything. They give them the okay and what's called the go live authorization. Not everybody, nobody started, as far as I know, on September 1st. I don't think anybody started literally on September 1st. I think it was at the earliest a couple days after that. And it was scattered throughout the month. Most casinos in the state are now offering sports gaming, but not all of them started even in early September. It rolled out over the month.
And then, as we mentioned, in October, mobile sports betting was introduced, and the Indiana Gaming Commission reported that Hoosiers wagered $92 million on sports in October, as we said, and that was almost tripling the wagers of September's numbers. How much is the mobile betting responsible for this jump?
It's responsible for a big part of it. In fact, more people wagered mobile bets on sports in October than they did in person at casinos. Mm. And that's with only three providers of sports betting compared to 13 or 14 in-person sports books across the state. So clearly and that was always kind of what we knew. There was analysis done and reports prepared as Indiana was discussing getting into this over the last year or so, everybody said, if you're going to do it, you kind of have to do it mobile because otherwise there's really not a lot of point.
Can you explain the business partnerships happening around mobile sports betting? What's the difference, for instance, between DraftKings and Ameristar Casino?
For the purposes of wagering on sports to a Hoosier, nothing. Ameristar Casino doesn't have an infrastructure set up to place bets online because it's not legal to do that in Indiana in any other way. So they're basically contracting with somebody who's already in the business of doing that, DraftKings, who got into this originally for fantasy football but paid fantasy football and now does more than that, basically running sports books for some casinos across the country. It's really an infrastructure issue. If you're Ameristar, you could contract with somebody who already does this and has the mobile infrastructure set up, or you could spend a whole lot of money to do it yourself, and there's no reason to do that.
Mm. Some have said Indiana's in a unique position to really capitalize on sports betting right now because our surrounding states have yet to green light the same rules. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's partly goes back to the conversation about the tax rate is you're trying to get people to do it here. But there's an important caveat to betting on sports in Indiana, even mobile sports. And this was in state law as well as Gaming Commission rules. We do what's called geofencing. You have to literally be inside the state of Indiana in order to place a bet on a sporting event, even on your mobile phone. So if I live in Indianapolis but I drive up to Chicago to see a Bears game, I can't place a bet from Soldier Field. Despite the fact that I am a Hoosier and I should be able to bet on sports. I have to be inside the state boundary of Indiana in order to place that bet.
Really?
Yep.
Do we see evidence that suggests people from out of state are indeed coming here to place their wagers?
I'm not entirely sure. It's possible that the Gaming Commission has that info. It's more likely that the actual providers themselves have that info, and my guess is they don't want to tell us that.
Right.
Because that would be proprietary. It's possible that information is available. I don't know. But it's possible that there is a way for them to know that, yeah.
Do people have to register for mobile betting in person?
No, they do not. And that was something that was discussed because we've seen that in other states. But no, you can, in fact, on the day it went live, just to make sure that what I was writing was accurate, I went on, I downloaded the DraftKings app, I filled out the profile, and if I'd wanted to, I could have placed money on a sporting event. I did not want to do that, so I didn't, but I could have if I wanted.
Have you gotten spammed since then?
not as much as I was expecting, no.
And there were a few other pieces included in House Bill 1015 that have to do with gaming but are outside of sports betting specifically. One piece is it allows Vigo County to open a casino, and they just passed a referendum to start that process. What in the bill allowed that to happen?
Oh, boy, you got the rest of the show carved out for this explanation?
Right.
No. It was a lot of moving pieces that has to do with a casino in Gary that technically has two licenses in one facility. If they decided, as they wanted to move off of their waterfront location to a more attractive location on the interstate in Gary, if they announce their intention to do that, then one of their licenses goes away and a new license is given to Vigo County. If the voters of Vigo County approve that referendum, which you pointed out they did, and now it'll go forward. And there's some other things that have to happen before that can open. People have to operators have to bid on it, and those bids have to reach like a certain level of investment in the community. If none of them do, then there's no casino, but we expect them to. And that plays out over the next probably year or two.
What's the most popular sport that people are betting on so far?
They do tell us some of the most popular ones, and so far it's been football. And I should clarify that that's American football, not as I would be betting on the English Premier League or anything like that, what we call soccer over here. But no, it's football by a pretty healthy margin, and we'll see those numbers change a little bit, obviously, as things are in and out of season.
And there are only so many licenses available in Indiana, right?
Casino licenses, yes. Theoretically, every casino operator could open a sports book if they wanted. So far, very few have. We'll see if, or excuse me, mobile. All of them is, or almost all of them, have opened a sports book, in-person sports book.
Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith, always appreciate you joining us.
Happy to be here.
And when we come back, we'll be joined by experts within the industry to talk about the trends that they've seen both on the ground, in casinos, and online. And we'll also hear from State Senator John Ford about what sports betting can mean for Indiana and the arrival of a new casino in Vigo County. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on sports betting, I want to tell you about a show we did last week that focused on veterans' mental health. We discussed reducing stigma, barriers to treatment, and where veterans can find support. You can find that show and all of our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. And today we're talking about the emergence of sports betting in Indiana. It's been just 2 months since sports books opened for Hoosiers to place their wagers. Last month alone generated over $1 million in tax revenue. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio today, we're joined by Indiana State Senator John Ford. Senator Ford represents District 38 and was a co-author of House Bill 1015, which addresses several gaming matters in Indiana. Senator Ford, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by David Stroh, the Vice President of Corporate Communications at Boyd Gaming Corporation. David, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us today is Chris Leininger, Chief Operating Officer at French Lick Resort. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
John, let's start with you. As a state senator, you were a significant supporter of House Bill 1015. Can you talk about why that legislation was important to you?
Well, I think it was important that to me that we bring sports wagering into a regulated market. We all know that it's been going on for decades. So if we could bring it into a regulated market, we could implement consumer protections. But then I also looked at it as a great marketing tool for our current casinos to help them stay competitive with neighboring states.
Not to mention tax revenue off the top.
Yeah, there's a little tax revenue, but it's, you know, we never came into this thinking this was going to be a huge tax revenue for us. It was more to help our casino partners and to bring it into a regulated market.
Were there other states that you modeled the legislation after? What were they doing that seemed to work?
Yeah, I looked a lot at New Jersey. One of the first early implementers, looked at Nevada, and really was part of a group of state legislators across the country working on this.
September saw the first month of legal sports betting in Indiana, and Hoosiers wagered $34.5 million on sports in that first month alone. Chris, you're the COO at French Lick Resort. What was that first month of sports betting like at French Lick?
It was a really exciting time for us because as we looked at the opportunity with sports wagering, we felt that it was an additional amenity that we would be able to offer the people that come to our destination, just like we have two championship golf courses, two luxurious spas, horseback riding, and a litany of other things to do. We saw it as an additional complement, and so we put a great deal of emphasis on building out our sports book. We have 14 big screen TVs and really showcase the environment with two 8x14-foot video display walls that really immerse you in all of the action that takes place on any given sports day. And so we saw people come in and just really be complimentary of the environment we've created for them to enjoy the various sports activities.
Before this officially came along this year, had guests expressed interest in sports betting before at French Lick?
Yes, it was interesting to us because as the news spread throughout the state, we actually had a number of golf groups call our reservation center and ask whether we had yet been permitted to operate our sports book because many of them traditionally have gone out to Las Vegas for various golf buddy trips, and they were looking at us as a new destination to consider.
And I understand that French Lick took the green light for sports betting as an opportunity to enhance the sports viewing experience in a lot of ways. What have you done to make that experience richer? You talked about the TVs all over and just sort of that general casino feel.
Yeah, I think what we've really tried to do is create a service-friendly environment. We put in a whole new service counter in which we have some of our own associates that have been with us for a number of years there to guide people through the betting process that may be new to it. And we also have 8 self-service kiosks that operate much the way that those at some of the fast food venues now have, where you can go through a series of menus and place your wagers depending on what type of odds you want and what teams that you're looking to wager on. So we really have tried to ensure that there's a broad spectrum of service depending on your level of sophistication.
David, you're joining us all the way from Las Vegas today, which is a place that's certainly no stranger to the casino and entertainment industry. But a new element to this equation has been the introduction of mobile sports betting. Mobile sports betting just began in Indiana last month, and $48 million were wagered through mobile betting in that operating month. As someone within the industry, can you talk about what the mobile betting market looks like right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you've seen in Nevada for years now and what's playing out in markets around the country is you're seeing a majority of betting activity is going towards the mobile app. I mean, and it usually it settles in around 75-80% of the market. That's what you've seen in Nevada, in states like Pennsylvania. I think that's probably where Indiana is headed. And we feel pretty good about where we're positioned with respect to mobile. Obviously, we have two very beautiful sports books and very successful sports books operating at Blue Chip in Michigan City and at the Belterra in Florence. But we've also brought on a very powerful partner. Earlier, you mentioned DraftKings. Boyd Gaming has entered into a partnership with FanDuel, DraftKings' main competitor in the daily fantasy sports space. And what we've seen is that's a brand that customers are very familiar with. They've gotten to know it over the last several years. Many of them already have the sports betting app on their phones. And so that positions us very well as mobile gaming rolls out to move out to a pretty significant market position in sports wagering in Indiana. What we've seen in Pennsylvania and New Jersey is FanDuel jumping out to a 50% plus market share. And so we're pretty optimistic as we start to see November come out, a full month of operations for mobile gaming, that Boyd Gaming and FanDuel will be in pretty strong position.
Yeah, David Stroh is the Vice President of Corporate Communications at Boyd Gaming, and we're talking about sports betting in Indiana. And Boyd Gaming has partnered with FanDuel in Indiana, which some people may be familiar with through fantasy sports. Can you talk about the ways in which these mobile platforms allow for fans to interact with sports?
Well, sure. I mean, it offers a convenience option so that customers can place their wagers and watch games from their own homes. And as we've seen in other states, customers do enjoy having that option. You know, as we looked at going into this, I mean, sports betting really wasn't anything new to us as a company. I mean, Boyd Gaming's been in business for 45 years now. We've been offering sports betting in Nevada for virtually all of those 45 years. So we're extremely familiar with the business and how it operates. But as we looked at some of these new states across the country, such as Indiana, we wanted to find a brand that would resonate with customers. This is going to be a very competitive market. So you wanted a brand that's going to kind of stand out and give us a chance to be competitive as we roll out sports betting. And FanDuel really has been that partnership that's helped us kind of stand out with mobile, with sports betting and with mobile gaming in a competitive market and jump out to a very strong market position.
Well, and along those lines, the new platforms, the marketing, do we see new demographics as well becoming interested in sports betting?
You know, that's a great point. And, you know, there's always that question of how are you going to get younger customers, millennials, Gen X, how are you going to get them to visit casinos? And it's been an issue that, as an industry, we looked at for many years. And I think that's honestly the most exciting opportunity afforded by sports betting. It gives you an opportunity to offer a new amenity to our customers that we haven't had before. And so it offers that opportunity to connect with perhaps a younger customer than the one we've traditionally marketed to. It gives them a reason to visit Blue Chip or Belterra that they haven't necessarily had before. And once in the door, we can then market the entire property and all of the amenities that we offer at these properties to those customers. And we think we stand a fairly good chance of converting a good number of them into long-term customers of our properties. And so it's early, obviously, but I think what we have seen in the four states where we've introduced sports betting over the last year really bears that out. You're seeing an influx of new customers. You're seeing an influx of younger customers. And it's really starting to show its potential to help us grow and to diversify our business.
You mentioned Blue Chip, which is pretty close to Illinois, a state which has not yet regulated sports betting. Do you think that states like Indiana that are ahead of the curve with sports betting are going to benefit from out-of-state business?
Well, I think clearly they are starting to see that, that you're seeing customers come from neighboring states to place wagers in Indiana casinos. So clearly the state is benefiting from that because customers are being drawn to this new amenity. We're certainly seeing that at Blue Chip from both Illinois and from Michigan. And then Belterra is, of course, right across the river from Kentucky, so we see that there as well.
John, did we get ahead of this in Indiana? We talked about Illinois and Michigan and maybe bringing in people. Was it sort of the idea to get ahead of this and bring in tourist revenue, essentially?
It was our plan, and we started working and educating members on this a few years ago when we passed Daily Fantasy. We were one of the first states to pass Daily Fantasy, and we kind of just kept the ball rolling in terms of education. But this legislation we passed this year did allow the Gaming Commission to move swiftly. You know, we really gave them a 2-month window and they were able to meet that, and we were placing bets on September 1st.
Mm. Chris, French Lick Casino is a little bit further into the state than, say, Blue Chip or Belterra. Did you see a bump in out-of-state folks coming to French Lick for sports betting, or have those numbers kind of remained consistent?
We are evaluating those as we continue to ramp up where our visitors are coming from. But as it relates to our overall visitation, we've always traditionally drawn from further away in all the radius around our destination. And so we've got to believe that the percentages continue to play into getting people to come here for other various reasons, just not specifically the casino activity. We have an awful lot of group business that we are able to capture throughout the Midwest, and we also have a pretty healthy leisure market, which really plays to how we feel like the sports wagering has the opportunity for perhaps somewhat of a casual player to come and take part in it as just another activity here while they're at the resort.
Chris Leininger, Chief Operating Officer at French Lick Resort. Considering, Chris, that mobile betting is something that people can now do at home, does that put pressure on brick-and-mortar casinos like yours to create a unique experience around sports betting?
I think that it has traditionally been that there's always going to be additional ways in which people are afforded opportunities to wager. We certainly have seen the expansion of the lottery industry here throughout the Midwest, and we expect that there will be a continued conversation about when perhaps traditional casino games go to an online platform. And what our position is that we distinguish ourselves in the overall experience we provide. We feel like there's a real clear competitive advantage to being here and experiencing a destination as we have to offer, as opposed to some of the more limited activities that folks can experience in these other types of formats. And so we think that they, in parallel, certainly there's concern that it draws away some of the discretionary dollars, but we think that people will always want to look to get away and relax in an environment like ours.
John, we talked about this number earlier this hour, but it's a big number and it's worth talking about. Almost $92 million was wagered on sports in Indiana last month across traditional sports books and mobile betting alike. Do you think that we'll continue to see numbers like this as the months roll on, or is this just a consequence of being novel and new right now?
I think there's definitely a factor of being new, and most of the states around us have not come online yet. And we know Ohio's working on it. We know Illinois has already passed it. And we know Michigan is working on it. So at some point, our numbers will settle a little bit. But we'll still be a great gaming, you know, sports wagering market here.
Vigo County is an area you represent, and they recently passed a referendum to bring a casino to the county. How did this referendum come to be on the ballot? Why was this a good fit for Vigo County?
Well, Vigo County has always been a large regional retail hub. So we get a lot of business from multiple counties in Indiana and a lot of counties in Illinois. And really, when you go west from Vigo County to Effingham, there's really not much there. So a lot of those folks already come into Terre Haute to shop. So this was, you know, already there. We were able to communicate that to members. And it really, as we modernized gaming, this was an opportunity that came about, and the citizens of Vigo County overwhelmingly supported this effort.
You think the proximity to Illinois has a lot to do with that, considering Indiana's gotten ahead of sports betting and also casinos for that matter?
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, this is really was the largest change we've made in gaming in 27 years. And it was really moving away from the theory of river towns or downtowns and really putting one out on an interstate. And, you know, that really resonated with members.
When can we expect the new casino in Vigo County to be up and operational?
If I had to guess, it'd probably be spring or early summer of 2021.
Okay.
Currently, applications are being taken by the Gaming Commission, and I would think sometime first quarter of 2020 we'd know who the operator would be.
Do we know where it's going to be?
No, that would depend on the operators who submit bids.
And we've talked a bit about the potential tax revenue that's at play here. What kind of revenue do you anticipate, and what are the plans to then spend the revenue on?
Well, like I said, from the get-go, this wasn't about bringing in huge amounts of tax revenue. So I think we're anticipating somewhere between $15 and $18 million annually. 3% of that is going to support addictions, and then the rest will go into the general fund for gaming.
David, if someone wants to give mobile sports betting a shot, where can they start?
Well, as you noted, you download the app, and you will be you will have a wide variety of wagers. And I suspect a lot of customers may be a little overwhelmed at first. That is perfectly normal. It is a brand new form of gaming that we haven't seen yet. You know, what we've seen a lot of customers gravitate towards, you mentioned earlier, is football. And it's kind of interesting because what you see is a little bit different by each market. I mean, in Las Vegas, it's all NFL. That is the huge weekend of sports. That's where you see all the activity in our sports books on weekends during the fall. And that's really the case in other states, but it really varies by what market you're in and what type of football people bet on.
Right,
in
right.
Mississippi, for example.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, yeah. I'm afraid. Thank you so much. There's a lot more to talk about. I'm afraid we'll have to end the conversation there. State Senator John Ford, thank you so much for being with us today. David Stroh, Vice President of Corporate Communications at Boyd Gaming Corporation, thank you. And Chris Leininger, Chief Operating Officer at French Lick Resort, we appreciate your time. Up next, we'll close out the show with a recent conversation I had with scientist Bill Sullivan, author of the new book, Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. The question of nature versus nurture and what makes us who we are has been debated for ages. Professor of microbiology at Indiana University School of Medicine, Bill Sullivan, might have some answers. He joins us now to talk about his book, Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Your book, Pleased to Meet Me, which came out this August, explores how our personalities and actions are shaped by our DNA. And I think many of us like to think that we're in the driver's seat when we're making our daily decisions. But how much does DNA actually come into play here?
That's a really good question. And like you said, it's been debated for ages ever since the notion that genes could start control things beyond our physical traits. So the research into my book, Pleased to Meet Me, uncovered several hidden forces, actually. In addition to our genes, there's this new science called epigenetics, which involves the environment and how it acts on our genes. And there's also these microbes that we carry around in our gut, especially, that can also affect brain chemistry and a number of things about our personality. The key thing I realized going through the research of this book is that our genes govern a lot more than just our hair color or eye color, but they have far-reaching effects into our personality traits and our behavior.
Is there a specific percentage of influence that DNA has over us in comparison to the other factors that impact our lives?
That really depends on what sort of trait you're talking about. So if you're talking about a simple mutation that might cause sickle cell anemia or Huntington's disease, for example, that's highly predictive. If you carry that mutation, there's a 99.9% chance you're going to have that condition. But when we're talking about complex behaviors, about you know, how aggressive someone might be, how risk-taking they might be, or even something like height, which has a strong environmental component and certainly intelligence as well, those you cannot point to a single gene and say this gene is responsible for this. It may predispose you for a portion of that, but it's not going to be the end of the story. The environment plays a big part, as do other genes and other gene networks. So they don't work in isolation. To answer your question, on the average for complex behaviors, genes have been found to regulate maybe about 40 to 60%, and the rest would be the environment.
Really? So it's not one or the other. It's a combination of both. How are you able to figure this out? What's the scientific process behind determining which factors are pulling our strings, be it our DNA or our environment or any number of other factors?
The initial studies came when people were trying to figure out how an embryo develops into a person. You start as a single cell, yet that cell, as it divides, can become a liver cell, it can become a spleen cell, it can become a brain cell. But they all carry the same genes. So what's going on there? How can they be so different if they all have the same genetic material? Scientists have also observed identical twins, which are genetic clones, also can exhibit different physical traits and behavior traits from time to time. So what's going on there? It speaks to the fact that there's more to us than just the genes. And what scientists have realized is that there's factors in the environment that can twist our genes like volume knobs. So they're not just turned on or off. They are regulated, and they can be turned up to 11, per se, to borrow a reference from Spinal Tap, or they can be turned down close to almost the off position. So you think about that for the 21,000 different genes in our body, that makes us very susceptible to what's going on in the environment. So there's a key part to that equation that we've been missing for a very long time, because everyone was so excited that there's a gene for this, there's a gene for that. And to a certain degree, that's true. But we can't let the environment play second fiddle. It's very important. It can change DNA in a number of ways.
You found that when we understand the impact that our genes have on our lives, it starts to help us better understand patterns of behavior. Addiction, for instance. Can you explain how genes can play a role in addiction?
This is really surprising. So addiction was long thought to be just an issue of self-discipline or self-control, willpower. And we're not saying that that's not true. But there are definitely genes that can strongly pull you towards an addictive personality. And that science is very well established now, some of which, especially for alcoholism, took place right here at the IU School of Medicine, some of the pioneering studies into that discipline. So people are finding that there's a number of genes associated with alcoholism in particular. Ozzy Osbourne, in fact, had his genome sequenced about 10 years ago. Scientists actively sought him out as a participant in their genomic study because they knew he had a lifetime of partying and he struggled with alcohol and drug addiction all of his life. And they were wondering, how is this guy still alive? How is he still going at 70 years? Still cranking out great music and, you know, doing remarkably well. And it turns out he had a number of variations within his genome that are speculated to have made him better at detoxifying alcohol. And there's also gene networks that they found that set him up to be predisposed towards alcohol, which actually are characteristics that many people who struggle with alcohol use disorder also have those same variations.
This is exciting for me. Let's talk about another trait, like overeating. That was also a behavior linked to our DNA. Can information like this help someone change patterns in behavior, or is it beyond our control?
It certainly can. And obesity is actually a very complex disease. There are a multitude of different genes that are being implicated in the process. And it affects how we treat the disease and how we go about solving the problem. So what affects about 10 to 15% of morbidly obese individuals could be a genetic variation in the system that tells our brain how hungry we are. So this is controlled by hormonal signals. As we eat, our stomach and fat cells start to produce a hormone called leptin, and it travels to our brain and says, hey, brain, we're full. You can stop eating now. And then as time goes by, the body starts to secrete ghrelin, which is telling the brain that, hey, your stomach's empty. It's time to eat again. This is a very elegant little system, and it's just one of several that have been found in the body. And if someone is born with a mutation in any part of that system, in the making of this hormone leptin or in the receptor of the brain that binds to it, it can disrupt appetite. So in other words, if people have a leptin deficiency, their brain never gets the signal that they've had enough to eat. So they tend to overeat at every meal and at every snack, and this is what ultimately leads to weight gain. The nail in the coffin, if you will, is when they make this mutation in mice, they do the same thing. So if they mutate the leptin system in a mouse, they start to overeat, and you get these huge puffy fur balls of mice.
We're talking about how our genes can kind of predetermine our personality traits and the like with Dr. Bill Sullivan, who is the author of Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And I'm curious about behavior. That cited as something that DNA can also have a hand in influencing. Does this mean that those born with a violent gene are destined to act violently?
That's a great question. And this is a relatively new science and a new appreciation for how far genes can really affect us. I mean, in hindsight, speaking as someone who works with genetics and genetics traits, it's not terribly surprising to me that genes are going to predispose us towards certain behaviors. But it's also not surprising to me that we can change things in our environment to either short-circuit that process or circumvent it in some way. So the primary case that is usually thrown out there as an example happened in 2009 with this fellow named Bradley Waldrop. He was the first person in history to be spared the death penalty because of his genes. And this was kind of a shocker at the time. But his lawyers effectively argued that because he has a mutation in a gene called MAOA, I'll tell you about that in a minute, that he could be exonerated, or at least the sentence would be reduced for his crimes. Because if it's a genetic mutation, then clearly, you know, you don't have control over that. That's just the way you were born. So how this works is that MAOA is an enzyme that clears neurotransmitters in the brain. It breaks them down and gets rid of them. And if you have a defect in that enzyme, these neurotransmitters can build up to a toxic level, which can cause you to lose your ability to impulse control, and it can cause you to be more aggressive, think without acting. So that is what Bradley Waldrop and many other people have this variation. So what sends the statistics through the roof, the odds of you being aggressive, is if you have that mutation and you grew up in an adverse environment where you were exposed to child abuse or bullying or neglect, if you have that combination, then you have a very high probability of suffering rage disorder or being aggressive. And that just really blows everybody's minds with respect to how we think about people who might bully or people who might be engaging in heinous acts. There's a number of other biological explanations for this that are not just within our genetics, but there's brain issues as well. We've seen in the news very recently with CTE, the concussions that some athletes sustain over time because of contact sports can cause their behavior to change, sometimes in murderous ways. So there's a multitude of different biological explanations for how violence can be a characteristic in someone.
So does that mean that trauma can kind of scar the genetic code?
It does at an epigenetic level. So this goes back to the chemical changes that can take place on DNA as a result of things in the environment. So one of the classic studies that was done not long ago were the study of mice or even children who were abused early in life. So what researchers have found is that this causes the silencing of a gene that clears stress hormones from the body. And there's a sound biological reason for why that would happen in someone who experiences trauma. People and animal models, when they experience trauma, they tend to secrete excess stress hormone all the time. It kind of puts them on edge, makes them alert. You can imagine there would be advantages. If you were in a perpetual stress environment, that would be a reasonably good thing. But it's also really hard on the body and the mind to be making these stress chemicals all the time. So our body has ways to get rid of them, to clean them up. And in individuals exposed to trauma, especially at a young age, their DNA is modified in a way that the system to clear these stress hormones is damaged. And it also predisposes them to being violent later in life. So you're right when you're talking about how DNA can be scarred, but it is done through environmental conditions, not necessarily the genes we were born with.
How are we able to know if we have a genetic disposition to a particular trait or behavior?
Scientists are getting better and better at this over time in cataloging all the different variations that they see in DNA and then what sort of traits that people exhibit. So genes have been found to obviously been linked to a number of diseases, like Huntington's or even cancer, things like that. And you can get yourself genetically screened for some of these diseases to see what level of predisposition you might have. But again, that doesn't consider the environment, which can change the equation at times. But when we get back to talking about complex genetic traits, like is my kid going to be violent? Is my kid going to have a drug problem? And so on. Those are virtually impossible to predict because the environment just has too much of a say in that sort of behavior. I kind of draw the analogy of a Jenga tower, you know, the wooden blocks that you put into a tower and then you pull them out one by one until the tower comes down. So when you're talking about a complex behavior like violence, if someone has one mutation, that's like pulling out one Jenga block, and it might not do anything to the tower. It might take several of those before the tower finally comes crumbling down.
You even say that DNA can be an indicator of your political affiliations. Is our DNA partisan, or can it be?
It seems that way. And these weren't studies that were done in my lab. These were done by other people. But there's some really interesting things coming out in terms of how our biology affects our behavior and then how those personality traits affects the way we vote. So the key gene implicated in this is something called DRD4. This encodes for a dopamine receptor in the brain. And dopamine is one of the key neurotransmitters that governs our reward response. So it makes us want to do an activity that made us feel good. So this dopamine system is really important in regulating how much activity people like to do. So whether they are risk-taking, whether they seek novelty, how exploratory they are, how unafraid of change they are, relies on the dopamine system. So in our human population, we have all kinds of variations in how we make dopamine and how we respond to it. And you can kind of see this, to put it simply, there's like two different people, ignoring all the ones in the middle. If you look at two different people, some are risk takers and some are not. Some like change, some are afraid of it. And that's how this manifests into our political differences, because liberals are usually the novelty seekers and conservatives are usually the ones who are comfortable with the way things are. So that's one example of how a gene could possibly sway where we lie on the political spectrum. The other genes build our brains. And since genes build our brains and then the environment affect how our brains look, this affects where we lie on the political spectrum. One study that researchers did analyzing brain images, they could end up predicting with about 75% accuracy just from looking at a person's brain scan whether they were a Republican or Democrat.
Fascinating information. Dr. Bill Sullivan, he's the author of Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure. It's a book that has a little something for everyone, so I hope people enjoy it. And to learn about the book, they can go to my author website at www.authorbillsullivan.com, all one word.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. You can get a podcast of this show or any past show wherever you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow on Indiana's Red for Ed Action Day, when thousands of teachers and supporters will descend upon the State House to demand, among other things, better pay for Indiana teachers. The rally coincides with Organization Day, the ceremonial start of the 2020 legislative session. Tomorrow, we'll talk to teachers, including the president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, about exactly what teachers want from the state legislature and how they hope to get it.
We're back tomorrow at this time for that conversation. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm at Matt Pelser on Twitter if you like. Thanks for listening. This is All In.